The opinions expressed are those of the program hosts and guests and are not those of WPSL's staff, management, or sponsors. WPSL does not endorse products that may be mentioned. Any reproduction or retransmission of this broadcast is strictly prohibited without written consent of WPSL. It's time now for the Raybuck Law Firm Radio Hour, and here's your host, attorney Michael Raybuck.
Hello again. Welcome back, and happy holidays to everyone. This is attorney Michael Raybuck, and you are listening to the Raybuck Law Firm Radio Hour on AM 1590 WPSL. I'm chief counsel at Michael Todd Raybuck PA, my law firm. We're located at 1025 Southwest Martin Downs Boulevard in Palm City, where we focus on two areas of practice: family law, including issues related to simple and complex divorce, spousal support, paternity, contempt, establishment and modification of orders, division of assets and liabilities, dependency issues, and children's issues. We also practice in personal injury litigation, representing clients who've been injured in auto accidents and negligence cases. In addition to being licensed by the Florida Bar, I'm certified by the Supreme Court of Florida as a family law mediator. I'm admitted to practice before the United States Federal Courts of the Northern, Middle, and Southern Districts of Florida, as well as the United States Tax Court. For the radio hour, we're going to focus our discussion on family law issues. Phone lines are open, and we'll try to answer your questions regarding divorce or perhaps a time-sharing situation you may have. This is an opportunity for free consultation, and family attorneys, like most attorneys, we're very busy preparing for court, preparing cases, and in between the various stages of litigation and research that goes into preparing for trial. We also have to find time to meet and consult existing and potential clients. Not nearly enough time to satisfy the demand out there for answering all questions associated with family law. And many attorneys like myself are also business owners, and our time is further constrained by the time spent keeping businesses properly managed. So the radio hour, to my thinking, is an opportunity to speak with you, the listeners. If you have questions about a family law matter or a personal injury case, in addition to contacting me here at the radio station, call me at the office. That telephone number is 772-600-8166. I'll be glad to schedule a free consultation with you or speak to you personally on the phone regarding your case. You may also email me at michael@theraybucklawfirm.com, and Raybuck is spelled R-E-B-U-C-K. Visit our website at www.thefamilylawattorney.net. You can email us right on the website, and on the website you'll also find links to Facebook and YouTube. So it's my goal today to address issues pervasive to the family law legal profession. And what I want to do today is talk about three subject areas that are interconnected and that they're all related to family law. And I see them often in my practice. Today we're going to go over premarital agreements, which we had begun to touch on in the last session we had here, and void versus voidable marriage as part of that. We'll also look at contempt and enforcement, which is a prevalent area of practice. And finally, we're going to look at children testifying in family cases. I'm here with Veronica this morning. Merry Christmas, Veronica.
Oh, hello. Merry Christmas.
All right. It's good seeing you again. Glad to be here right before the holidays.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Oh, good. I'm not. I have to get creative this weekend.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Well, you get creative, and I'll try to stick to the script. All right. Premarital agreements. We talked a little bit about this last week, and I want to go over briefly, somewhat summarize what we talked about, and then relate premarital agreements as to issues of void and voidable marriages. Premarital agreements are under the ambit of Section 61079, which is called the Uniform Premarital Agreement Act. That section of 61, which is the family law statutory section, applies only to proceedings under the family Florida rules of procedure and not to other provisions like probate rules in the state of Florida. And a premarital agreement is basically a prenuptial agreement. It's an agreement between prospective spouses made in contemplation of marriage and made to be effective upon marriage. The marriage is, in effect, the consideration for that contract. And property within a premarital agreement can be basically any interest in personal or real property, be it tangible or intangible property, and includes things like passive and active income and earnings. So retirement would be a property under premarital agreement. These prenups must be in writing and signed by both parties. They're enforceable without consideration other than the marriage itself. As we've said, the marriage essentially is the consideration for that contract. And parties to a marital agreement may contract with respect to just about anything if it's of a legal nature and it's not going to compromise the rights of children. So things like the rights and obligations of each party in any of the property that either of them have whenever and wherever they've acquired it or it's located. The right to buy, use, sell, transfer, security interests, mortgages, encumbrances, the disposition of property upon separation, marital dissolution, death, or the occurrence or non-occurrence of either event for each party, and ownership rights in the disposition of death benefits, like a life insurance policy. Also, the choice of law governing the construction of the agreement can be made a part of a prenuptial agreement. Parties can decide where they would litigate in the event things went bad and they had to address the prenup in terms of what to do with it. They can decide on the forum at the time they make the contract. As we've said, the premarital agreement becomes effective upon marriage. But what about amendments or revocation or abandonment of the agreement? Well, after a marriage, and presuming that the agreement is now in place, it can be amended only by written agreement signed by the parties. So you can't just decide amongst yourselves, hey, what about that provision that indicated what we would do with our real estate that we own that's not, you know, a marital home? Well, you would have to get it in writing if there were going to be changes to the agreement, and both parties would have to do it, and they would have to basically state in writing that we specifically want to amend this portion or all of the agreement. What about enforcement of an agreement when things actually take place that would require that to happen? Well, a premarital agreement is not enforceable under certain situations if a party against whom the enforcement is sought can prove things like the party did not execute the agreement voluntarily. Maybe there's a situation where there was fraud or duress, you know, not necessarily putting a gun up to someone's head saying, hey, sign this, but there could be many different forms of fraud or duress that may have occurred at the time that an agreement is signed, and the party seeking to avoid enforcement would have to show that. Also, an agreement could be deemed what's called unconscionable when it was executed, before execution of the agreement, and that party basically was not provided a fair and reasonable disclosure of the property or financial obligations of the other party. Basically, a situation where things of a financial nature were not properly revealed as part of what was intended to be that agreement. If a provision of a premarital agreement modifies or eliminates spousal support, and that modification or elimination causes one party to the agreement to be eligible for support under a program of public assistance at the time of separation or at the time of the marital dissolution, well, in that case, a court, notwithstanding the terms of any agreement, may require that the other party provide support to the extent necessary to avoid public assistance eligibility. In other words, the state, the taxpayers, are not going to take the responsibility of a party or parties with respect to issues of, well, I'm going to be on public assistance now because we have a prenuptial agreement which basically divests me of any interest in everything that we've accumulated together. Every case is going to be different, and certainly that would be something that the trier of fact, that a judge would have to look at, but it is something that would not necessarily lie. A court is not going to just necessarily let the taxpayers pick up those expenses. So an issue of unconscionability of a premarital agreement, it's always going to be decided by a court. I mean, the issues of unconscionability, anything related to the possibility that the agreement was voidable or was not appropriate, the court's going to have to make that decision. And along those lines, what is a void marriage? If a marriage is determined to be void, an agreement that would otherwise have been a premarital agreement is enforceable only to the extent that it's necessary to avoid an inequitable result. And what I mean by that is, well, we have to basically look at void marriages in Florida. An annulment is a familiar term, and I've often asked, do you do annulments? Well, in Florida, annulments exist almost in a void. There is no family law code in Florida that specifically addresses annulments, and the courts do not assume that any individual has an undeniable right to an annulment. Basically, the short version of this in practical terms is that we don't have annulment laws in Florida. You basically go down the divorce route with some very narrow exceptions, which we have to cover to make this a full summary or review.
What would be the difference between divorce and annulment?
Well, an annulment...
I always thought that annulment was like it never happened.
That's correct. That's okay. Basically how it is.
But so really a divorce is sort of like it never happened too, unless there's kids and complications.
That's right. A divorce is basically when something goes wrong in a marriage. To get an annulment, you've got to basically prove that a marriage was either void at the outset or was voidable because of something that happened subsequent to the marriage taking place. Yeah, a divorce is something is what happens when something goes wrong in the marriage. And the standard in Florida is that the marriage is irretrievably broken. It's a fairly simple standard to achieve, and it's fairly routine in Florida. Divorce litigation happens very much. There are many, many family law attorneys and many pro se litigants out there who go through the divorce process. But for an annulment to be granted in Florida, as Veronica was stating, you must convince the judge that the marriage was never valid in the first place. So it's important to look at what a void and a voidable marriage is. Those are actually two very different things, just so the folks understand. Florida makes a distinction. A void marriage is one that never should have been permitted by existing law in the first place. Bigamy would be an example of a void marriage. Obviously, you can't marry more than one.
How about
person.
I got drunk in Vegas, wound up married, and I really, after I sobered up, I thought twice. Does
that
work?
That may be an example of a voidable marriage.
It only works in
marriage.
Vegas.
No, that might be a situation where it would be deemed voidable. An avoidable marriage, that's a pretty good definition of it.
Yeah. It's one my husband's not who he said he was. You know, you find out he's like got this whole other life or something.
That's exactly
right.
See,
I blame
right.
the husband, not the wife.
Yeah.
I'm bad.
Yeah. It's one where there's grounds that might exist at the start. We had this great time in Vegas. But then something comes to light later that should nullify it. Like, for example, he's not who he said he was.
Okay.
Yeah. If the spouse lies about something fundamental and the person marries them anyway, relying on what was told, then this would be another avoidable circumstance. Mm-hmm. Same type of thing. And you're required to prove one or the other in Florida to get an annulment. There's no specific statutes in Florida to govern annulment. So here judges fall back on existing case law to make that decision. This means that they will look at decisions handed down by other judges and try to decide if the case meets the same criteria. And for this to happen, of course, a trial is required. And proof of a litigant's reasons for the annulment must be provided to the court. And although I never like to say never, it is exceedingly unlikely that an annulment will ever be granted in default or by default in Florida. A judge is not going to order a default judgment just because a spouse did not respond to a litigation for purposes of an annulment. I think in those cases, it's best to just go down the divorce route, and I would probably counsel a client to that. I've never actually had that circumstance, but I read about it, and apparently it has happened and does happen from time to time.
Is there an advantage to an annulment over a divorce?
Simplification.
Okay.
I mean,
well, everybody wants that, but
yeah, I mean, the divorce laws have become so simplified in the easiest of all cases. I mean, I actually had a divorce that took 4 days from the time of inception. Mm-hmm. The parties were both motivated. The one came to my office, and the other one had prepared documents. We filed everything, and they were like, "We don't need notice. We'll just get the first available hearing date." Mm-hmm. And it was. Just
find
quick.
Us a judge.
And this was a long-term marriage. I mean, they just had everything together in that particular case. And I guess the thing is, I get so many questions about annulments, and there are so much confusion out there about them. I thought it would be an interesting subject mm-hmm. to talk about simply because there are folks who will want to pursue annulment versus divorce just because of void and voidable type issues. It's not something that we deal with a whole lot, but it's important for people to understand there's no statutory provision for it. If we're going to go down the annulment road, you better be able to prove it to a judge. Otherwise, you might as well just go down regular divorce, which I guess becomes a cost issue and then simplification issue. Like I said, annulment, if it is in fact an annulable marriage, should be relatively simple.
I mean, can you be married 20 years and get an annulment?
If the marriage is voidable, there are very narrow circumstances where that may be feasible. You know, there's no statutory, so there's got to be case law out there, and I'm unfamiliar with it, frankly. But there could be case law that voids a long-term marriage that maybe should have never been.
I mean, because that's really not like, oops, I made a mistake.
Did you see Liar Liar with Jim Carrey?
I did. Love
that
movie.
Remember that scene at the end where it turns out that she had entered into an agreement and she had not been of age to
right.
enter the
she
agreement.
Was too
they
young
voided
to
the marriage.
Enter the contract.
And
yeah.
that had been a long-term marriage as yeah. well. So, you know, I mean,
and
that
kids
was,
involved. Great movie.
Yeah, it was a great movie. It was hilarious. And it's obviously not reality. But at the same time, it was a different jurisdiction, too, as well. I want to say it was like a California case. So obviously every jurisdiction is going to be different. But that was an instance of a long-term marriage being voided. So,
yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the grounds. The bottom line is that it's very difficult in Florida to establish grounds for annulment. You're going to they're going to involve grievous misrepresentations by one spouse, fraud, duress, dire consequences if you don't marry me, something called consanguinity, which is, you know, related by blood. You learned after the wedding that you're related to a person by blood, in which case you've got to, you know, voidable marriage. Or impotence. Impotence.
Surprise.
Right. And that's right.
How come I never met you at the Christmas parties?
Extended
family
cousins.
Reunion?
Also, impotence. Impotence means that one party is incapable of having sex. It should be not be confused with sterility, which is an inability to procreate. Obviously, another potential ground is bigamy. If your spouse was previously married and that marriage never ended by divorce or death, this would be ground for an annulment because it also constitutes a void marriage. Now, real quickly, disqualifications in Florida. There's no judicial code to govern annulments, so it's possible to start down this road, go through an entire litigation, have the judge deny the petition. So even if your marriage meets every single criteria to qualify for an annulment, if the marriage is consummated, if the parties had ever had sexual relations, after they learned of the nullifying circumstances, annulment's not going to happen, is the bottom line. So there's limitations of these actions, things like latches and estoppel, which are basically deception-type defenses. They're available to the parties. And like we stated earlier, the probate laws and other statutes are not subject to these provisions. Family law stands alone with respect to the discussion of what was the first thing I said here? I'm sorry. Oh, premarital agreements. Yeah, premarital agreements basically stand on their own. They are of their own statutory ilk, and other laws like probate laws would not be applicable. So if you have questions with respect to those items, give me a call on annulments and or premarital agreements, and we'll move on to our next subject here. I had a question from D in Rio regarding contempt and enforcement. And D writes an email, I just received my ex's attorney-driven motion for contempt and enforcement. And when I saw attorney-driven, I immediately thought, there's the animosity. There's an attorney involved and they're screwing with me. And this attorney-driven motion was filed. And now how do I deal with it? So I sort of
hire an attorney.
Yeah, exactly.
You need to go,
That's right.
You need to become attorney driven yourself.
I'm going to be your best friend, even though you don't like me. And you don't like us generally. And that's just fine.
Well, sometimes it's necessary.
We're necessary evils for many folks in the family law section. That is certainly that certainly can be the case. But Dee says that since 2003, I've been ordered to pay $330 a month for child support, and I've not complied with that. This would have equaled $35,640 in child support payments from the date support began. Dee goes on to state, in fact, I have paid the state depository over $75,000 in that time. My counterclaim is my ex has alienated my daughter. I've called her house over 30 times in the past year, and no one has been answering, and no one has returned my calls. I have not talked to my daughter in months, and I'm very upset. How should I proceed? I've been out of work for a long time, and I have no property. Well, Dee and Ryle, I hope you're listening, and thank you for your question. This covers a lot of ground, actually. It's not just a child support issue, and it's not just a civil contempt issue. We'll talk a little bit about what's going on here. Okay, so once you've been served a motion for civil contempt enforcement, it's up to the other party to schedule a hearing and to send you a notice of that hearing on the motion for contempt. You're going to have to appear at the hearing to defend yourself. And the party filing the motion has the burden to prove their allegations. In this case, their burden is most likely to prove that a valid order exists and that you're in violation of that order. It's very simple to prove these elements if the case is a child support case, and it seems indicative from your statement that the funds are being paid through the central depository and or the state disbursement unit. So once the petitioner shows these items, The burden's going to then switch over to the respondent, and in this case, this would be UD, and you'll typically have to provide that you don't have the ability to pay. So they establish that the order exists and that there's an obligation that's not being paid. Then the other side, you, would have to basically show, well, despite all that, I don't have the ability to pay. Fairly simple arguments, and the court's going to have to make a decision based upon that evidence, case law, evidence and testimony. Case law is pretty specific. But there's more to this case than just unpaid child support. Based on what the inferences that I read in your motion or in your email to me, it looks like you can file a motion for civil contempt and enforcement yourself on your ex-spouse as well if you have a previous court-ordered visitation schedule that she's in violation of. Even if you've not made child support payments, an ex-spouse cannot deny you contact or visitation. One does not beget the other. The failure to pay child support does not interfere with a parent's right to see their child and spend time sharing with them. Further, if a visitation or a parenting plan has not been ordered, and given the fact that you've contacted your daughter 30 times over the past year at her mother's home and no one's returned your calls, I think that it may be possible that there is not even a plan in place, in which case you may want to file for one. There is cost associated with doing that, but you may qualify for deferred or waived filing fees since you indicated you're without a regular income. And your ex is being represented by an attorney, so I would certainly recommend that you do the same. And you should at least get legal advice by meeting with a family law attorney. So I would recommend an attorney in or near the county where the hearing will be taking place. So obviously if you're in Rio, St. Lucie County, I'm assuming it's a St. Lucie County case, so you would want to talk to somebody local here. And as with any domestic legal fight, you should be prepared and familiar with family law rules of procedure, with documentation and copies of pertinent receipts, accounts, and et cetera, if you plan on taking this on pro se, plus any witnesses that are necessary with respect to your issues. You would want to have them lined up and ready for the hearing date. And this question leads us into a discussion of contempt and enforcement in Florida generally. So what is contempt? I've been sort of using this phrase, and some of you probably know and are familiar with contempt because it's such a prevalent area of enforcement that lots of people know what this is, at least in a general way. But more specifically, contempt is basically refusal to obey a legal order or a decree. It's an act, also an act of intending to embarrass or obstruct the court's administration of justice and to lessen its authority or dignity. For example, if you swore out loud in court, you could be subject to a contempt proceeding. You know, disrespecting the court, those types of things, and they do happen. I've been in dependency court very recently, and there were certainly instances of potential contempt that took place, and courts will enforce contempt. Florida courts basically have that power to protect themselves against individuals who disregard, you know, authority and disobeying orders. Individuals include any person before the court, which means parties to the litigation, any witnesses, even attorneys. Yes, I myself am subject to contempt proceedings if I decide to, not wear a tie in court or something one day, and I've got a judge who's pretty specific about that stuff. I'm kidding.
you could see me. I was going to ask you, really?
No, there's a sign in the Martin County Courthouse that says you'll be appropriately dressed, and every time I think of that, I think, you know what? I'm not a big tie guy.
Do you check make sure you got the right clothes on?
That's right. I make sure that tie
is there any
is on
such
the
thing as casual court? You know, dress down Friday?
Not for the lawyers, I would say no.
I am teasing.
And I always encourage my clients, if possible, you know, wear some nice clothes because that goes far with a lot of judges. There are two kinds of contempt in general, civil and criminal contempt. Civil contempt is remedial and is used to coerce a party into complying with a court order. If an obligor, for example, is not paying child support, alimony or attorney's fees and costs, and the court finds there's a willful disregard for the court's order, and that obligor has the present ability to pay, well, then incarceration may be an appropriate sanction until such time that that contemptible person purges and pays the money that's owed. We're right up against a break, and we'll return to discuss criminal contempt. This is Attorney Michael Raybuck on the Raybuck Law Firm Radio Hour. We'll be right back.
This is WPSL Port St. Lucie, the talk of the Treasure Coast.
FNN News, I'm Reagan Smith. The weather is making headlines in the Sunshine State on this first day of winter. The high today from Pensacola across to Jacksonville may top out only in the 50s. Then lows at or below freezing tonight. It'll stay chilly on Saturday.
I would think the best will do on Saturday. Well, even all the way down in Miami, it probably won't get out of the middle 60s Saturday. And I'd say Orlando will be stuck in the 50s all day.
Meteorologist Jack Boston in the Florida Weather Center says it could be even colder Saturday night into Sunday morning before we feel some warmer air on Sunday. In spite of lower gas prices across the Sunshine State, Patrick DeHaan of GasBuddy.com says most drivers surveyed by the agency say they're not spending much more this holiday than they did last year.
51% of them said gas prices and related transportation costs aren't forcing them to spend less than usual, but that means a good chunk of them, 43% of Americans, said that, yes, high gas prices and transportation costs are forcing them to spend less than usual this Christmas season.
Gas prices have dropped to an average of $3.24 statewide, but DeHaan expects prices to rise as soon as next week. Two top deputies of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton grilled on the Hill by the House Foreign Relations Committee about the attack in Benghazi. The panel's chairwoman, Florida Republican Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Lehtinen, says even with all the investigative reports, there are still some glaring questions that haven't been answered.
Why was the State Department unprepared for an assault there, especially on the anniversary of the worst terrorist attack in United States history?
Secretary Clinton says she's putting into place 29 recommendations from high-level panel that studied the deadly assault on the U.S. consulate. Republican lawmakers say that the State Department ignored warning signs of danger. With news on the Florida News Network, I'm Reagan Smith.
Yes, it's football season, and that means tailgating with friends, cheering for our favorite teams, and traveling to stadiums near and far. When trekking to any sporting event, use caution when approaching railroad crossings. Remember, trains cannot stop quickly. In fact, an average freight train going 55 miles per hour can take 18 football fields or more to stop. That's a long way to carry the old pigskin. So always remember to look, listen, and live. A message from Operation Lifesaver. Find out more at OLI.org.
Hiring someone without a professional license can be dangerous, and it could cost a hardworking professional their job. Before you hire a contractor, visit a salon, or get your next haircut, make sure you're working with a licensed professional. You can check Florida State licenses at myfloridalicense.com. That's myfloridalicense.com. Licensed, tested, trusted. Hire a Florida licensed professional. For more information, go to myfloridalicense.com.
The Florida Supreme Court is asking the legislature to create 63 more trial-level judgeships. Larry Spillman reports.
The justices cited high workloads due to prior budget cuts that have reduced staffing. They acknowledged that a falling crime rate has taken some of the pressure off the courts, but wrote that judges still are dealing with a backlog of mortgage foreclosure cases. The request is for 47 new county judges, whose duties include misdemeanor and traffic cases, and 16 additional circuit judges who handle felony cases as well as foreclosures and large lawsuits. I'm Larry Spillman.
The High Court has made similar requests in each of the past 6 years, but lawmakers have authorized no additional judgeships in that span. The alleged ringleader in a 2009 attack in which his South Florida middle school classmate was doused with alcohol and set on fire, sentenced to 11 years in prison. For more news that you care about, go to myflanews.com. Reagan Smith, FNN News.
Steady cool, you'll never find it. It exists without effort, hence cool. We now elect presidents based on this, apparently. But the real joke, that social consciousness makes you cool. Come on, that's just...
You're listening to the Ray Buck Law Firm Radio Hour on WPSL 1590. Now back to your host, attorney Michael Ray Buck.
Welcome back. This is Michael Raybuck. You're listening to the Raybuck Law Firm Radio Hour on AM 1590 WPSL. If you have questions about family law or personal injury, call me for a free consultation at 772-600-8166. My office is located at 1025 Southwest Martin Downs Boulevard in Palm City. Email me at michael@raybucklawfirm.com or visit the website at www.thefamilylawattorney.net. So we're talking about the two different kinds of contempt, civil and criminal contempt. And as we stated before the break, civil contempt is a remedial form of contempt. It's used to coerce a party into complying with a court order. Criminal contempt, by comparison, is a punishment tool, and it's utilized to sanction a party for his or her failure to comply with a court order. Criminal contempt can be direct or indirect. Direct contempt is basically a contemptuous act that is committed in the immediate presence of the court, as we stated before the break, acting out in court enough that a judge will warn you and then ultimately contempt you if the behavior doesn't stop. Indirect contempt is basically an act committed outside the court's presence, and that would be certain degrees of violations of orders that would lead to the potential for things like incarceration. If we're talking about criminal contempt, we're basically talking about serious sanctions that would include incarceration. Civil contempt, by comparison, does include the possibility of incarceration, but that's more of a coercive or remedial nature, whereas with criminal contempt, the singular purpose of it is punishment. So enforcement of contempt, or enforcement and contempt. Florida courts retain jurisdiction over matters that have been previously adjudicated. This means that after a court delivers a final judgment regarding, say, a divorce, the court has the ability to enforce its ruling if one of the parties violates that order of judgment. And in family matters, the most common violations have to do with support payments or complying with the equitable distribution of a final judgment in a case of a dissolution of marriage. In order to enforce an order or judgment, the Florida courts have the ability to enter monetary judgments for vested arrears, garnish the violator's wages, maybe place a lien on a violator's property or suspend a violator's professional or driver's license. They can also do things as extreme as data matches, which is basically taking bank accounts in certain circumstances. Enforcement for violations of existing court orders is similar in some ways to injunctive relief, which, as we've discussed in previous shows, has to do with hostile behaviors alleged by one party against another, certain kinds of domestic violence. Sometimes a party will file for enforcement action for violation of the timesharing court agreement that exists, be it permanent or temporary. And sometimes you'll have a parent for, let's say, a mother who has primary visitation, timesharing with a child. And in some circumstances, that party will, you know, whether it's through some belief that as the majority timesharing party that he or she has greater authority than the other parent or some other subjective rationale, that party will see fit to violate the other party's timesharing allotment, withhold the child from the other parent in one form or another. I see this very often in my practice, and offending parents will come up with all sorts of reasons for not showing up at exchanges, refusing to give up the child for various reasons, and otherwise just making themselves unavailable to the other party at the place and time for exchanges. Sometimes violations of the timesharing order or the parenting plan become systemic in a relationship, and that happens over and over again. Inevitably, these cases become contempt proceedings, and the judge is going to need to step in and enforce upon the terms of an existing order. If an offending parent cannot or will not recognize that his or her behavior is in violation of an existing order, well, then it becomes quite difficult to avoid contempt through efforts to negotiate or change behaviors. If parties are going to consistently violate the terms of an order regarding, for example, timesharing issues, then it's inevitable that contempt is going to happen, no matter what the parties believe otherwise. There are no circumstances that I'm aware of that a party can just unilaterally make the decision to violate the terms of an order. Judges will take this very seriously. It all relates back to undermining the authority of the court is what it comes down to. Parties simply cannot do that. They can tell their story to the judge. They can give their rationales and explanations. But, you know, those explanations are almost invariably going to be emotional on some level, very subjective, and the court simply isn't going to rule in that party's favor.
And I see a trend of people bucking authority from the very beginning. They gave their mother and father a hard time. They gave teachers a hard time as they grew. Now they're, you know, say in their 30s, and I don't have to listen to you.
That's a great point, Veronica.
I can do what I want.
That's a great point. And people, you know, parents are just as culpable as kids in some regard. They get into a mindset that they are right and let the judge prove otherwise. Mm-hmm. And you know, until both parties lawyer up and the fees are paid and you go through the litigations, it becomes a very expensive endeavor to prove your rightness. But you're absolutely right.
Right.
Some people will simply have to buck the system. And they do it until they learn otherwise.
Or it costs them enough.
Or it costs them enough. Or in some cases, I guess, they get what they want. Because the caveat in all of this is sometimes it's both sides. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just both sides pushing the buttons. Mm-hmm. And a judge will eventually step in and just say, you know
what? Because that's
enough.
What they did before the divorce. It's just like nothing changes.
That's right. That's right. But just to summarize this point, there are folks who simply cannot understand that the authority that the court has to mm-hmm. dictate its rules to them under parenting plans, enforcement orders, and whatnot. Because let's face it, a lot of times these parenting plans are voluntary. I mean, people enter into them and then they're adjudicated. And for some reason, they cannot grasp that, listen, I did this voluntarily. Now you're telling me that I have to do it. I mean, it's a common occurrence, but at the same time, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. In the end, an order means exactly that.
That's it.
This is an order, and you have to abide by it. So very briefly, I want to change subjects here, or change directions to get into our last subject, and sort of preface it by addressing motion practice in Florida. There are four general rules that attorneys go by when filing motions with the court. I'm going to summarize them very briefly. This is more of an ethical thing. It's canonized on the Florida Bar's website. I mean, there are rules that attorneys essentially go by. But for purposes of motion practice, there are four ethical considerations that lawyers abide by, and that when you hire an attorney and there's motion practice, things that need to be done for purposes of getting the case to the end, these are the things that the clients will typically see. And if they don't see them, they should expect them, because these are basically not hard and fast rules, but they are rules and standards that all lawyers essentially go by. Number one is that lawyers should avoid unnecessary motion practice or other judicial intervention by negotiating and agreeing with other counsel whenever practical. For example, before setting a hearing for a non-dispositive motion, meaning a motion that does not affect or address the final outcome of a case, counsel should make reasonable effort to resolve the issues. I mean, that's something that you would expect from your attorney. Number two, a lawyer should not force an adversary to make a motion and then not oppose it. Candidly, that type of thing does happen. Sometimes one side of a litigation will feel like, oh, it's necessary, file the motion, I'm not going to oppose it. But they won't do anything unless you do that. So in essence, it becomes necessary for you to file to move the case along. Not something that I would typically employ as a case strategy, but it does happen. But it really shouldn't. Number three, after a hearing, the attorney charged with preparing the proposed order should prepare it promptly, about a day, no more than a day. Unless, of course, it should be immediately submitted to the court, in which case then it better be by the end of business. The order must fairly and accurately represent the ruling of the court. In other words, don't say something in the proposed order that the judge is going to sign that the judge didn't say. That will be caught either by the judge, and judges are very busy. They've got to count on lawyers to some degree when they're signing these orders because they have a lot of them. And if it's not the judge or the clerk that catches it, then obviously the attorney on the other side, given the circumstances, may say, you know what, that's not what the judge ruled at all, and we need to amend that. So, and then, of course, the fourth one is, before submitting a proposed order, attorneys should provide the order to opposing counsel for approval, either orally or in writing. It just cuts down on confusion at the front end of this and gets cases to be done much more quickly. And that sort of prefaces the last subject that we've got here, which is children testifying in family cases. I'm often asked at what stage or at what age a child is allowed to testify in court as to which parent the child wants to live with. In Florida, there's no clear-cut answer to this question. For a child to testify in court, especially as to which parent the child wants to live with, well, that's got to be done by motion. It's got to be filed with the court, and the ultimate decision really lies with the judge. Judges have very different opinions about whether children should ever testify in family cases. Even if a child is 17 years old, a judge may not necessarily allow him or her to testify. We cannot presume that a 17-year-old child is mature enough to make a decision with respect to things like where he wants to live.
Yeah, tell them that.
Well, obviously. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Will a judge meet with the children? Like,
absolutely.
Not, okay.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm going to go over a case strategy that involves that very thing mm-hmm. in just a moment. But the important thing to remember, because I get this question so often.
Because
in fact,
that could be like mom's secret weapon.
Yes.
You know, in court.
Yes, absolutely.
I want my kids to talk.
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. that's right. And that's going to be a very common theme, because kids are going to have their predispositions as to what they mm-hmm. want. And, you know, we're going to have to deal with is that really what's in the child's best interest? Children can testify under certain circumstances, but it is not going to be something that is very common. That said, I deal with this issue so often in really any heated litigation that I have. This question is going to come up because my client or the other side are going to want this to be part and parcel to the case. And I will often see on the court's calendar motion for child testimony. Personally, I don't commit to that practice unless it's absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you why. The rationale behind the limitation is that the court system doesn't want to place the child in the middle of family disputes. One of the biggest issues that a judge considers in determining time sharing is whether or not a parent has been discussing court proceedings or has otherwise made the details of the court proceedings known to the children. That is a factor that's in the statutes. It's codified in 6113. And that is, being that it's there, it's important. And you'll see it at a trial. I had a trial recently where the judge simply went down the list of every factor in 6113, and that was one of the factors. Which side put the child in the middle? And let me tell you, that didn't go well mm-hmm. for the other side. Mm-hmm. Judges are going to inquire about these types of things. They're going to apply their findings to their own checklist for the issues of a family case. Now, every judge is going to be a little bit different, but on this particular issue, children being placed at the center of litigation, it's my experience that judges are very particular about who's doing that. Subjecting a child to testify in court and deciding which parent he or she wants to live with places a child directly in the middle. I mean, it just does as a matter of fact. And of course, this is going to emotionally compromise a child, and probably the child's best interest is going to be called into question. If a child testifies that he or she wants to live with the father, for example, well, then that child's relationship with the mother may be forever damaged. So not only is the judge making a judgment call here and a ruling based upon things like who's putting the child at the center, but the party who's aggrieved by the testimony, that could affect the relationship between, say, mother and child. Mm-hmm. A parent may punish a child for testifying against them. And is that in a child's best interest? I don't know. But that's the kind of thing that a judge is going to look at. In general, I can tell you that I'll only file motions to – I mean, I'll allow – motions to allow a child to testify if my client is adamant and wishes to do so. But I always forewarn them. In my opinion, even bringing the motion before the court, it may appear unfavorable. And because it may appear unfavorable, I sort of like to dissuade it. And by dissuading it, that doesn't necessarily mean I'm ruling it out. I'm just dissuading it because, look, I think that in my estimation, this could compromise your case. Mm-hmm. It illustrates the client's willingness to place the child in the middle of the litigation. A much more effective alternative, I feel, is to present facts and allegations to the court that comes directly from the parties, be it from their evidence or their testimony, and then allow a judge to decide whether he or she wants to hear from the children on his own merit. Let the judge make the call in that situation. I had a case last year. There was an act of violence that occurred at a party where the children in the case that I was dealing with were in attendance, and the ex-spouse of my client was involved in the violence. We presented a motion to the judge that basically regarded the facts of the incident as it occurred. And upon learning that the children had witnessed aspects of what happened, the judge ordered the children to testify. So you see how we sort of went around that direct approach. Oh, mm-hmm. We want the kids to testify.
Right.
Because we really didn't. And in this particular case, my client was just like, look, it will help the case. It will present the case and let the judge make the call. So he was on board with what I had been telling him all along. And ultimately, that's what happened. The judge took the testimony of the children, and, you know, by ordering them to testify, we took out the whole thing of who's going to be
against
who.
Who put them
who.
In the middle, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So irrespective of the children's testimony, neither side's going to be prejudiced in the court's eye by a willingness or eagerness to get the child's story. The judge makes the call. Be mad at the judge. They don't care. Mm-hmm. And the judge is always going to act in the best interest of the child anyway. So in that particular case, the court made the call reviewing the facts, and
I would also seem to think that the kids may be coached.
Absolutely.
By one or the other parent.
Absolutely. I mean, that's another reason that judges are often hesitant to allow a child to testify. The judge's decisions are going to be based on what's in the best interest of the child. And a child's not going to know what's in his or her best interest. Right. They're going to decide, this is what I want.
Well, depending on the age of the kids, they may want to go live with whatever parent is more lenient.
Well, that's right. Like you said.
Advantages.
Absolutely. There are going to be situations where children are being coached or might be being coached. Mm-hmm. They're told to testify a certain way by one of the parents, and then that child becomes afraid to testify, contrary to what that parent has told the child to say. And what is that going to lead to? It's going to lead to confusion, misstatements, miscaricatures. The child's going to get caught up in, if not lying, certainly mm-hmm. getting mm-hmm. confused because, oh, I need to say this, but the truth is...
And the judge is going to know that.
The judge is going to know yeah. that. I mean, they've been doing this for mm-hmm. so many thousands of cases that it becomes right. very pattern specific. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're not going to fool a judge. Certainly a child is not going to be able to fool a judge with respect to what they have to say. A child may, of course, make a decision regarding which parent they want to live with. And they're going to base that upon circumstances that are pleasing to the child, but not necessarily in the child's best interest. Well, daddy is a little more lenient with homework. Mom lets me stay out later, you know, stuff mm-hmm. like that. So even if it's not necessarily a coaching situation, and I'll tell you, there won't be coaching if there's a parent who knows my child's going to want to be with me. Mm-hmm. They may try to stay out because they already can count on, well, you know, it's going to be, I'm the favored parent, and I know that's the deal. The coaching may ultimately come from the other side. Hey, well, can you sort of give me a break here?
Yeah,
And in the end, I always feel it's best to get the child. If you're going to get the kids in front of the judge, let the judge make the call.
Yeah. It's human nature to go, well, what's in it for me?
Absolutely.
Deciding where I'm going to live. Well, what's in it for me?
Yep. And at that age, your viewpoint is so limited that you don't really see the forest through the trees. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's in my best interest at 17.
Right.
Heck,
right.
I'm 44 and I have questions. I always know what's in my best interest.
There you go.
I mean, like I said earlier, I usually find that other witnesses other than the children can be called or other evidence submitted that is sufficient in use of the place of a child's testimony.
Are the kids usually in court? I mean, are they usually present?
No.
During? Okay.
Almost never.
I would, you know, my kids, I would think I would not want them there.
Yeah, and that's generally true. And almost never are children. In fact, it is basically never. They're,
okay.
They aren't there
unless
the judge
they
wants
have
them
to
be there.
Okay.
That's correct.
All right.
If a child's going to testify that he or she is involved in extracurricular activities in school and doesn't want to leave those activities, you know, I can easily prove that a child's involvement in these activities, and the judge can reach the same conclusions that the child is happy and well-adjusted in his or her school if I have other witnesses or other evidence to make that evidence or part of the court record. Likewise, if a child would be testifying that he or she has a bad relationship with the other parent, that can usually be established by other witnesses as well.
And if you're talking 17, they're probably having a bad relationship with both parents.
Absolutely. At that point, if they don't have their driver license, you're really just driving them back and forth anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly.
Taxi service.
Now, there are some instances in which case nothing can really replace the child's testimony, and that would be cases where there's physical and or emotional abuse involved. If there's an allegation of abuse, a judge is going to be more likely to allow a child to testify. It's important to remember here that there's not an exact age the court has to hear the child's testimony. Most judges have a presumption against the child testifying, but the older the child is and the stronger the allegation as to abuse or similar issues, and factors like maturity will come into play, it's more likely that a judge will allow a child to testify under those limited circumstances. And like you were saying, if it comes down to a child having to testify, the judge may just simply take the child into chambers mm-hmm. and ask them questions directly. Sit down with the child, ask questions. The judge can usually ascertain the information that he or she needs by asking, you know, questions about the child's relationship with the parents, what activities the child does with the parents. Usually the judge can determine from these questions what the child's preferences are without directly asking, which parent do you want to live with? Mm-hmm. Even if the testimony is concluded outside the presence of the parties, there's usually a court reporter that's present, or there's a recording device, and the child's testimony will still be recorded for either parent, and you have access to it when it's done. So, and honestly, I feel in the few times that I've really had to get the children involved, in every case, it's always been a situation like this. I've always sort of used, it's not misdirection, it's just a better case strategy.
Right.
Don't create conflict with the child at the center of it. Let the judge make the call, and what happens is the judge takes the child into a private room. In fact, the judges will often allow the attorneys to sit in and participate maybe ask limited questions, but the judge basically runs the show mm-hmm. in those cases. And I've really never had any objection with that. As long as I'm not the progenitor of the issue, I'm creating the mess, or my side is creating
right.
the child being at the center, I don't really have a problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if I have to be on the other side of that, and it's the other side, and there's maybe, in my estimation, some judgment issues, either with the counsel and or with the client, I counsel my clients fairly heavily as to the direction the case is going to go. I mean, at all costs, I do not want conflict in relationships. I mean, the only way people are ever going to get to the end is together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in case of a divorce, sure, the relationship's going to end, but they're going to have to get to a certain place before that ever happens. And with children, it blows yeah. up the emotional
aspect. No, you're stuck with each other until your kid's 18.
That's right.
All the kids are 18.
That's correct. An alternative to a child testifying is to also have the child see a doctor, counselor, mental health professional, custodial evaluations, something called home studies. And if this is done and the doctor or counselor is determined to be an expert, this will be dependent on many factors, establishing expert witnesses, then the child's testimony may be admissible simply through these individuals, another option to the direct approach.
Now, would a judge have them do that, or would the attorney suggest that?
Either one. The okay. attorneys can suggest those situations. Very often, judges of their own volition will make that call themselves. And both are equally effective, in my estimation. The counselor may also be able to state his or her opinions as to whether the parent or child should live with, and provide specific information as to which parent would be more appropriate. The option may not be applicable in most cases, but it's ultimately up to the judge. Obviously, said there's many factors applied to determine, okay, judge, do I want to make this decision on my own listening to the kids? Do I want to get a professional involved? Every case is case by case. What I will say, I guess, to sort of summarize this, is that the parties get to a point where they recognize the court's rationale for doing things the way they are. If cases can be disposed relatively easily by simply doing fact-finding and asking questions, judges will generally do that on their own. Getting a counselor or a mental health professional or a doctor involved, generally more detailed, specific-type cases where a judge is looking for an outside professional or expert opinion mm-hmm. to go with what he thinks. Sometimes cases are close calls, and a judge with their caseload and other factors may not be able to make an informed determination. They'll get other people involved to sort of hash that out. And then finally, I just want to state here in closing, because we're up against the end, allowing a child to testify in a time-sharing family case, it's not a decision that's ever going to be taken lightly due to the emotional toll that it may have on a child and the child's best interest, and the repercussions that a child may face because of the way he or she testifies. There are instances of judges who will simply never allow a child to testify under any circumstances. I heard about a judge over in Hillsborough County who simply will never allow that to be a part of his court proceedings. So it does happen. This should not frustrate litigants from doing their best for their child's best interests. The decision of whether or not the child shall testify is ultimately going to be made by a judge anyway. It's going to be based on many factors, and it's going to be based upon, in the end, it's going to be based on the best interests of the child as the judge sees that. Although there is no specific clear-cut age in which a child can testify in Florida as to which parent he or she wants to live with, the older the child is and the more serious the issues, the more likely it is that a judge is going to allow the child to testify as to which parent the child wants to live with. So that is a pretty exhaustive summary of what happens with respect to children testifying in family court cases. I have been involved in direct testimony cases. I do not favor them. But with every litigation, we will have that discussion. We will, as attorney and client, go over the best strategies for it. And ultimately, we're going to try to achieve what is in the children's best interest. We are done here. I want to wish everyone a Merry Christmas, a Happy Holidays, and certainly a Happy New Year to those of you who will be traveling next week. I will be live on the air on the 28th to have a new show. Veronica, Merry Christmas to you as well. I know you'll be gone next week, so I hope you have safe travels
Thank
if you.
You
go anywhere. This is attorney Michael Raybuck. You've been listening to the Raybuck Law Firm Radio Hour on AM 1590 WPSL. Take care, everyone.
CBS News is next on WPSL Port St. Lucie, the talk of the Treasure Coast, a service of Port St. Lucie broadcasters.